for the intermodulation distortion product, the 2x1 I get at this particular condition from the amplifier number 1 and the 2x1 I get from amplifier number 2 are on the exact same frequency. They're different in amplitude and different in phase angle. Therefore, they add in peculiar manners depending on what's the transmission line length. Even if the first stage and the second stage is inside of the same box, there's still a length of transmission line, so to speak, between the first amplifier and the second amplifier, which means that there's a phase shift of the intermods, the 2x1 from the first stage and the 2x1 from the second stage, do not necessarily add in the worst case voltage matter.
It's repeater, timeout.
They really add in a vector manner considering amplitude and phase angle. So I'm guessing that's where you might be going next. And you can study it as a Monte Carlo. You can try plugging in various lengths of transmission line between the two and seeing the worst case and the best case situation. But when you go to third, fourth, and fifth stage downrange, all of a sudden the problem starts blowing up real fast as far as non-predictability of the results are concerned. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, I understand perfectly what you're saying, but let's say I'm just sticking a two-tone test in there, all right? I've got the fundamentals, I've got the second harmonic, and I've got the third harmonic. Now, the second harmonic is X number of dB down from the fundamental. Okay? And as I look at the second harmonic, to the left and the right of it, I get two intermodulation products. The intermodulation products, compared to the second harmonic, is always 6 dB lower. But when I do this, when I look at the third harmonic, and I look at the intermodulation products to the left and right of it, there's a difference of 9 dB between them. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
The second harmonic is X number of dB down. The third harmonic is X number of dB plus something down. The close-in intermod products are the 2x1. Upper sideband 2x1, lower sideband 2x1. The third, the 3x1s have to use the third harmonic mixed with the second harmonic. The third harmonic is weaker than the second harmonic. Therefore, and then usually you're sort of asking, should it be 3 dB down, 6 dB down, or 9 dB down? There, I'm not sure. But the 3x1s are going to be weaker than the 2x1s, and should that difference be 6 dB? Let me think about that. I think the answer is yes. The 2x1 is fundamental to the second harmonic. The third harmonic is 3x2. The third is already 9 dB down from the fundamental. I think you're very close to right, Eric. The catch here is that you're assuming a particular wave shape of the saturation characteristic of the amplifier. Let me drop this.
Well, let's just assume they're all sinusoidal. I mapped it out, and I'll tell you what I came up with, and you tell me if it's right.
Yeah, by the way, not all amplifiers saturate the same way. If you do a real intermod study with a bipolar versus a FET amplifier, you do see some peculiar effects. The first thing that'll bug you is that the upper 2x1 and the lower 2x1 are not the same amplitude. And the way a bipolar amplifier works in saturation and a FET amplifier works in saturation are not necessarily the same. And even if you choose two separate bipolar and two separate FET amplifiers of two different brand names, again, you'll get different characteristics. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I did my proofs and math and worked the opposite direction and made myself crazy, but what I essentially came up with is 20 times the log of the fundamental over the second harmonic, and that gets me 6 dB. And then for the third harmonic, it was 20 log over the second harmonic divided by the third harmonic, and that came out to around 9-something dB. Well, at least that's what I think it is.
For the beginning of the saturation at the 1 dB compression point, it might be a little bit lower than that, Eric, because in the case of the 2x1, the 2x1 is two signals being mixed together, And let's assume that the mixer is an ideal mixer. The local oscillator, so to speak, is the fundamental. The second harmonic is the signal being mixed. And the product of those, the 2x1, is another 6 dB down, so to speak. In the case of the 3x2, the next guy that's out, you're now using the second harmonic as the local oscillator. It already is something like 6 dB down from the fundamental. You're using the third harmonic as the signal. So both of those are weaker signals as a local oscillator and as a signal to be mixed with it. So they could be falling off another 6 dB from the 2x1, maybe even more than that. But as you can see, the mixing product, when you're shy on LO, you start falling off real fast. And every real mixer, when you start starving the local oscillator power, the mixing product starts falling off real fast. W, Eric, KQIRW.
Yeah, KQIRW, K2J. I'm with you. Well, I could go out and buy a nice, fancy, snazzy intermodulation program, but I figured I'd try writing one myself, so. All right, I'm going to move on to the other thing, and this one perplexing me a little bit. Let's say we've got a two-port device. We've got a source and a termination. And let us now say that the source and the termination are not perfect on each end, right? And what I suspect from what I see using a directional coupler is that I'm getting multiple reflections from one end to the other. And because of the angular arithmetic, it's kind of hard to follow. Got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is another thing that we plotted on the real B1 program. Because every amplifier has an input impedance that's less than perfect, an output impedance that's less than perfect, and you're cascading amplifiers and you have length of transmission line between the two, when you sweep it in frequency, you're going to be getting ripple. There are certain places where the reflection from the second amplifier back to the output of the first amplifier, and then re-reflect it forward again, that those two signals are now in phase and out of phase. So in between each stage of imperfect source and load with a certain length of transmission line, as you sweep it in frequency, you're going to be getting ripple. And now when you go three amplifiers downrange and they're all connected with cables in between, and you try to plot all of those ripples, it becomes a Monte Carlo. You get all kinds of possible characteristics. Eventually, it all kind of settled down into one peak-to-valley ratio that doesn't grow quite as fast as you think it would. Let me backtrack for a second to the first stage, though. If you had the world's best, most accurate mathematics of intermodulation distortion prediction, let me drop. You spent $30,000, you bought the best amplifier, you bought the best analysis program in the world. Would it buy you anything? Not necessarily. Real amplifiers, particularly bipolars and to a small effect with FETs, as you go into the 1 dB compression, not only are you getting a curve in the power output versus power input curve, it's no longer straight line, starting to operate on a curve that's bending over. That's the amplitude characteristic. There's also a C swing going on. The effective capacitance of that junction is different at the peak versus the valley of the voltage being produced by that junction. When you start plotting C swing and other parasitic effects within the transistors, if you really want to know the intermods of that particular amplifier, buy the amplifier and measure it. The world's best computer program will tell you the ballpark. It'll never get you the home plate. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, actually, I started looking at that based on Joe RYY's thing with his duplexes, tuning it up against, you know, perfect 50 ohm loads and then hooking it up to a real receiver. I actually stuck my vector network analyzer on the inputs of various different receivers, and none of them looked like 50 ohms. So that's when I discovered that there's more than just a single reflection going on.
That's for sure. And every reasonable construction of a duplexing filter assembly with six cavities, three on the transmit side, three on the receiver side, I say is capable of numbers like 110, 115, and 120 dB of notch depth, if and only if you tune it in the real in-situ situation in a non-contaminated manner. I mean, if you're plugging in a directional coupler in between the filter and the receiver trying to measure reflection coefficient, you've added a length of line by doing that, and you've changed the environment. So by various crafty techniques, in the real environment, you put that real duplexing filter into that real receiver connected to that real antenna, and if you're crafty enough by sneaking signals in just right, you can now tune that filter to a hell of a lot deeper notch than you got on the bench when everything was pure 50 ohm loaded. The real world is different, and that filter is capable of a lot more performance if you align it in a crafty manner in the real world. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
You know, I had those thoughts. K2LAW, K2EJ. Now, as far as like when I did the first experiment with the directional coupler, I actually measured the length of the directional coupler and changed the length of the cable. And then that going into the stimulus source from the vector network analyzer, it kind of keeps everything close to each other. And when you look at the Smith chart, you see with this vector addition and subtraction that seems to be going on. And as you change the tuning, of course, it all changes.
Yeah, and the your directional coupler is close to 50 ohms, but not exactly. The length of cable you added is close to the right length, but not exactly. So you've come a lot closer to the in-situ situation. But if you can do it without the directional coupler in there, there are ways you can sneak in the signal to measure the real isolation without putting in a directional coupler. Let me think, how would I do that? If I knew how much leakage I've got from my coax cable, there's ways I can force some very strong signal to go through the shielding of the coax cable. Now I'm injecting a signal that I want to measure the isolation of without disturbing the network. I didn't say it's easy.
A sampler that comes close to that.
Except that. But even that sampler has got a certain length, and it's got a certain it's got a certain susceptance, if you know what I mean. It's got a certain amount of reactance to it because of the way it works. So it comes close, but you got to be careful. But I'll bet you have seen, when you tune a duplexing filter, the best you can tune it in a 50-ohm world on a test bench, and then you plug it into the real repeater, if you're willing to spend the time retweaking it, I'll bet you can make that notch a hell of a lot deeper on the receiver side. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, that depends upon the type of duplexing filter also. I've got the type that uses quarter wave shoves, and I've got the type that has a little considerable capacity that runs between the elements inside the cavity. But the thing that I'm always fighting against, because when you tune it, if you're using, say, a spectrum analyzer and a tracking generator, let's say you've got a real vector network analyzer, and I've measured the input impedance to the vector network analyzer, and that's as close to 50 ohms as I've ever seen. Whereas the spectrum analyzer doesn't come close. But with the vector network analyzer, as best as you can tune it, you can get the imaginary number out of that and use that to calculate what the difference is. But, you know, ultimately, doing a desense test is kind of the best way you can get the notch in its best spot, but then you don't get a way to measure it.
If I picked up a self-respecting, real, well-built spectrum analyzer, like a Hewlett-Packard 8566, and if I use it with 10 dB dialed in to the front end attenuator, I'll bet you that input impedance of that antenna analyzer is extremely close to 50 ohms, Eric. I think you've been using Brand X spectrum analyzers. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
No, not Brand X. The one that I got right now is a Keysight, and it's like 49.976, and slightly, ever so slightly capacitive, and then they've got the service monitor, which is not close to just swimming on the high side at 51 something. And then I've got erosion force, which is dead nuts 50, and it's like, yeah. And then the problem that I have with even the service monitor is I use a 10 dB pad, but the 10 dB pad's in at 50 right on the nose. Just, and I'm talking RF wise, not DC wise. They're close, but there's variations between all of them.
Yeah, but even that variation you're talking about, 49 and a fraction ohms, that's a standing wave ratio of 1.01, so to speak. That's a hell of a lot different than the receiver you're going to put that duplexing filter into. The real receiver is a lot further away from 50 ohms than the examples you're giving me. Howie's got something to say about all this. WB2HWW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Howie.
I hope I'm transmitting right now. Dick, K2RIW, one of the things, when I try to tune up a duplexer, and I've done this in the past, I hook up the spectrum analyzer after the preamp. You come from your duplexer, you go through your pass cavity, you put your spectrum analyzer on the gas, on the output of the gas set, because that's what you're going to be doing. You assume that if you hook up the gas set, the output of the gas set to your service monitor or to your receiver, there isn't going to be that much of a difference on the input side of your gas fed. Now, sometimes after tuning it up on the bench, you have your transmitter going in, you look at your transmitter through the gas fed, and then you play around with the rejects, and that's going to help. You can get a very good notch looking at it, so you got the actual transmitter going into the rejects. You're looking at the rejects on the receive side. So you're really not going to hurt your duplexer because you're tuning it. You're not tuning the passes with a lot, you know, because you're running high power. That's one way to do it. So if you're looking, if you have the gas set, and the gas set is going into your service monitor, then if you take the gas set from the service monitor and put it on your receiver, let's say a remote track or a mic cord or whatever it's going to be, you're not gonna have that much of an impedance change on the input side of your gas tank. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. You're using the gas fed amplifier as an isolating amplifier. Assuming that's what the duplexing filter is really going to feed in the real world, that exact gas fed amplifier in front of your repeater receiver. And now you go one or two stages downrange with your sampling for the tuning of the duplexing filter. You're now tremendously isolated. That technique of doing the measurement downrange is something that's extremely valuable when you're doing radio telescope radiometry. If I wanted to measure what is the noise power coming from that particular star, and if I'm using an attenuator that is plugged into the IF strip of the radio telescope receiver, I'm now attenuating in the IF strip, and I first aim the antenna at the star, and I make a noise measurement. I then aim the antenna at cold sky, and I make a noise measurement. And I'm equaling those two measurements by way of an attenuator, X number of stages downrange in the receiver. I'm now making a real measurement of the difference in those noise powers. Let me drop. You'd be amazed how many people think they can put the attenuator in front of the receiver. Absolutely not. I'm going to give you a couple of reasons why. Even if your attenuator was a perfect 50 ohm load on every one of its steps of attenuation, even if the receiver itself was a perfect 50 ohm load, your antenna, when it's aimed at cold sky, if it's an antenna with good side lobe control and it's up at a good high altitude above the horizon, it is a cryogenic source. In other words, it's looking at the, let me pick a number, 70 degree Kelvin sky, as opposed to a 79 degree Kelvin star. And now, because the environment of the antenna is cryogenic, depending on how much attenuation you put in front of the receiver, and your attenuator is at a is at a 290 degree Kelvin world. It's at room temperature. There's now a noise source in your attenuator, which is not there on the real antenna, and you come up with crazy readings. You cannot put the step attenuator in front of the receiver when you're making radio telescope measurements. In the same case here, you don't want to put the measuring device in front of the receiver. You want to put it downrange after some stages of isolation. I wonder if you see what's going on there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW and SECNET. Good measurements here, you guys.
K2LIW, K2EJ. I know, I agree with Howie with his method, and I've done that. But there are, you know, being in this commercial world and being in that environment, there are places where you're just not going to put a gas vet in front of it. With the Vectrex network analyzer I actually have, which I didn't think of doing, I've got an option that allows you to look at mixers, so that means you'll be sweeping at one frequency and looking at another. Whereas a lot of the commercial receivers will get you access to the IF, so you just have to simply realize that you're coming out at a different frequency, but you can still do that same measurement. And I think that's what I'll do in the future now. That's a really intelligent way to go. K2RIW, K2EJ.
And there's one step beyond, Eric. One of the things that's hard to realize is that when the RF amplifier, when the RF signal goes into a mixer on the front end of a receiver, maybe after the RF amplifier, gets mixed down to an IF. The IF is at a lower frequency. And now for the network analyzer to work, the network analyzer in theory has got to convert that back up either in mathematics or in reality with hardware. Because very few network analyzers can tolerate an input signal and an output signal that are not on the same frequency. However, once you correct for that problem, the thing that's hard to believe is that if you shift the signal by 50 degrees in RF, it shifts exactly 50 degrees in the IF after the mixer. The phase tracks, even though they're on different frequencies. So therefore, it is possible to have a network set up mathematically or reality with your vector network analyzer that can tolerate the different input and output frequencies. And it can track phase, therefore you can go through a calibration procedure where you're now getting exact S11, S21, S12, and S22 measurements at the RF frequency, even though you're sensing in the IF. Ain't that crazy, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
WB2HWW with another serious comment on this subject.
Let me finish first. Actually, when I set up the network analyzer in the what they call a mixer mode, I do my through calibration, and everything follows perfectly. It is a crazy thing. It's the fact that if there's a phase shift, it follows. So that's you, Dick.
Okay, Howie, WB2HWW, go ahead with your comment. K2LIW and TechNet.
You know, when you're tuning a duplexer in the real world, I don't know if you need a vector network analyzer. You just want to get absolute best numbers. You don't need exact numbers. You just want to say, okay, I got an improvement. You want to get the best rejection and the best pass. That's the reason why I use a gas vet. And you know what? If you can't put a gas vet in front of the receiver because you're not going to use a gas vet like you're going into one of these new radios, then you sample off the IF or somewhere. You know, all you're really looking for when you're tuning a duplexer at a repeater site or on a system, you want no descents. So basically, you want to make sure that you have least amount of energy. Do you really care what S11 is or S122, what the return loss is, or, you know, what the forward or reverse path is? Yes, it's nice to have that. It's nice to have all that math and see that on a graph when you get a brand new duplexer from a factory, you know, from the manufacturer. But if you're tuning a 526 or a TXRX duplexer, I think all you're looking for is the maximum least amount of attenuation through the passes and the most rejects and the best rejects. Back to you, Dick. And you know what? You're going to have a service monitor. You're not, you know, how many guys are going to have a network analyzer? It's nice to have it. but I really think at the end of the day, you just want to get the best absolute numbers.
Well, Howie, I just happen to have one, and I like using it.
Yes, you don't have to know the exact phase angle of what's going on at the input of your receiver. Therefore, in theory, you don't need the vector network analyzer. However, in the case of Eric's vector network analyzer, and I think I know the one he's got, it quite possibly has, if he goes to the 50 KCIF or he goes to the 50 Hertz resolution bandwidth mode, his vector network analyzer could very well have tremendously higher dynamic range than the other instrumentation he would have used. So he's using the vector network analyzer because he likes it, because it's so steady, because it's got high dynamic range, even though he doesn't need the phase angle of the result on the front end of the RF stage, if you know what I mean. So there's various reasons he's using it. And my favorite vector network analyzer is a Rode & Schwartz. And I think you might have copy. You might have access to a Rode. Is that true, Eric?
You know, you got to understand, in the TV world, we have to be very precise about how we tune the match filters and everything. So that's really an important piece of gear. Most TV stations don't own one. They rent them when they need them, or they hire an outside engineer to do it that carries one with them. And of course, they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller these days. I happen to have the one that I use for my ham stuff, which is really cute. It's battery operated. Not quite as spiffy as the big monster that I have, but it's close enough, that's for sure.
Very fine. Okay, we're going to go to the next person. I hope we haven't put him to sleep. John? KC2SHO. In Los Alamos, New Mexico. And when you go to QIZ.com, you see a picture of a very pretty shack with lots of equipment. Reminds me a little bit of KC2WGB's pictures on QIZ.com. Go right ahead, John. KC2SHO, New Mexico, K2IW and TechMac. You got it, John.
KC2RW, KC2SHO, good evening to you, everyone else on the net. First off, unfortunately, that shack is no longer a thing. It's now defunct, and mostly in boxes in my garage. Someday we'll do that again. Unfortunately, the rental property at the moment, that might be a little ways away. We'll try to do whatever we can here in the meantime. And also, my apologies for the loss. I believe his name was John. I really did this. I enjoyed hearing his comments here on the net. I also have a tight trigger on this Dolphin I'm using, so I will occasionally lift. I'm going to lift now, and then I will pose my question. Okay, so the other night I was reading a document handed to me from a coworker about an RF reference line we have here at the Linear Accelerator, and it went into great detail about how a directional coupler actually works. And there was something in there that he didn't expound upon, but it got me thinking, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on it. What he said in the document, and this is probably a PhD who wrote the document, was that the Hertz field, the E and the H field, are both coupled into a directional coupler port. I was wondering if you could comment on how that works. K2RIW, KC2,
I'm waiting for all the beeps. If you go to amateurradio.tv, or if you go to limontechnet.com, in either case, you will find articles by K2RIW on calibrating a directional coupler used for power measurement and standing wave ratio measurements. And the main thing you're doing with that calibration is measuring directivity. The slug of your bird watt meter, your directional coupler, whatever, they all have a finite directivity. If it's a good quality directional coupler, let me drop. If it's a good quality directional coupler, it's got 20 dB of directivity. If it's a high quality, it's got 30. If it's an instrumentation grade directional coupler, it's got 50 and more dB of directivity. Directivity means that in the forward mode, it should respond to signal that's going forward only. In the reverse mode, it should respond to nothing if it had perfect directivity. Every real directional coupler has some finite amount of directivity, and you hope it's a big number, but you can measure it. By way of that article, I can tell you how to take any mediocre directional coupler and make it perfect at your particular frequency. There's ways you can calibrate it, there's ways you can correct it externally. You don't even have to climb inside to do that. Now, every radio signal on a transmission line, no matter what your transmission line is, I don't care if it's the tapping of a guy wire and you're watching a pulse go up the guy wire. I don't care if you're dropping a pebble into a pool of water and you're watching the waves spread out. I don't care if it's a radio signal going down your transmission line. Every signal going down a transmission line that has a defined characteristic impedance, so to speak, keeps the signal that goes from left to right and the signal that goes from right to left thoroughly independent of each other. These are independent, non-coupled events. Let me drop this. All those radio signals that are flowing through the air in your room right now from all of those local broadcast stations are thoroughly independent events. In the air in your room, they do not mix, they do not couple, they do not do anything. In order for a signal to have that degree of directivity, the signal that you mount, that you launch into the left-hand side of a transmission line is going to go to the right-hand side. No other signal will be there if you don't have any, as long as you don't have any reflections. In order for that signal to have that kind of directivity, it has a pointing vector, mathematically speaking. Pointing vector is E cross H. In other words, if I start off with my thumb pointing forward and my fingers straight up in the air, and my fingers represent the E field for a vertically polarized signal, that means that the H field is horizontal in my example. And if I pay attention to the polarity of the E field and the polarity of the H field, as I rotate my fingers, and I rotate about my thumb, E cross H, I rotate from E to H with polarity taken into effect, I am now advancing as a right-handed screw thread, the signal flowing in the direction of my thumb. I know exactly what signal, what direction it's going to go. So in order for a signal to have a clearly defined pointing vector, it has to have a clearly defined amplitude of E, amplitude of H, with the polarity taking into effect. That's where the directivity is coming from. Your directional coupler, in order to have directivity, let me drop this. It is simultaneously sensing the E, and it's simultaneously sensing the H. In the case of a directional coupler that's made out of a TEM structure, in other words, the NADA type directional couplers that are made with strip line, you have a straight through line, a strip line, you have alongside of it a parallel coupled line in strip line that is some distance away, and that parallel coupled line is on average a quarter of a wavelength long. That line is coupling some of the signal from the straight through line by capacitive coupling. It's coupling some of that signal from the straight through line by inductive coupling. The magnetic field flowing around that straight through line induces a voltage into the coupled line, where the voltage on one end is positive and the voltage on the other end is negative. The capacitive coupling produces a voltage on one end that's positive and the voltage on the other end that's positive. So you get co-phase coupling into the coupled line by capacitive coupling. You get opposite phase coupling by magnetic coupling. That explains how the signal adds at one end where the output connector is, and it cancels at the other end where the internal 50-ohm termination exists on the coupled line. So does your directional coupler sense both E and H? Absolutely. It has no choice. It would not have directivity without it. Let me drop. An opposite example is the capacitive probe you have on a slotted line. The capacitive probe on a slotted line samples the capacitance of the signal flowing through on the straight through line of your slotted line. It does not sense any of the H field. It's insensitive to the H field because of the method of construction. As such, it is a non-directional coupler. the signal that goes from left to right and the signal that goes from right to left, an equal amount of it will couple into the sampling probe of a slotted line, because it is a non-directional coupler. It's non-directional because it is sensing only E and not E plus H. Wonder if that all makes some sense then, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW, detect that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's all 100% clear. They definitely have a bit of a curve to work on there. But also, that's interesting. So with the slotted line, the power measurement coming out, would that be taken the same way? In other words, when I put my power meter on a directional coupler that has those in the H field coupled to it, I'm getting a certain RPM power. Now, if I was a non-directional coupling, would you have to make some calculations to get the right power out of that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I wonder if your Baofeng is running low on voltage because it's starting to make some funny sounds, but your audio is still good, not to worry. Because the probe on a slotted line does not see the difference between the signal going from left to right and the signal going from right to left, and it mixes the two together. Therefore, as you slide that probe along the slotted line, at some particular point, the left going and the right going signal are in phase and you get a peak. At some other point, they're out of phase and you get a valley. And the peak-to-valley ratio, we call it standing wave ratio. It's the non-directional characteristics that give you that effect. In the real world of using a slotted line as a power sensor, hopefully you've got a perfect dummy load on one end, therefore there's only a signal flowing in one direction, therefore when you move the probe along the line, it shouldn't change. And could you calibrate that for measuring power? Absolutely. If you knew the coupling coefficient, there's ways of confirming that. In fact, the easiest way to do it is to start off with a known power transmission, like 1 watt, into the slotted line, into the dummy load, and you adjust the probe for some convenient amount of signal strength on your indicator. Then you go to the unknown power, and however many dB up or down from that point, can you calibrate that into exact number of watts? Absolutely. As long as you've got a known good dummy load. If you don't have a good dummy load, then you've got to be a little bit more careful. Now you've got to slide the probe to either the peak or the valley and know where you are, if you know what I mean. But is the probe in the ideal world a proportional watt meter? Absolutely. Properly calibrated, that's got at least 60 dB of dynamic range. KC2, SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
That was very good. That's quite interesting. I love this subject, and I will read more and try to understand more. I'll also look up those past articles. It'd be interesting to see what's available there. Real good, Vic. Always a pleasure to hear the net. I'll try to get more active as we get settled here. And you may not remember, it was a long time ago, but I should say that I mostly moved and relocated because I had an opportunity to work more and RF, and here I'm getting that a little bit of look forward to the rest of the net and more next week and so on and so forth. K2RIW, always a pleasure to see you.
You and I have something in common, John. In my early days, I was so RF interested and hardware oriented. On a couple of occasions, at the company I was working at, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, I was offered a promotion into a more managerial position. Because I wanted to touch hardware and I wanted to really get involved in the RF, I turned down those promotions on a couple of occasions. At the time, it seemed like the right thing to do for me. Well, in the big picture, there were a number of people who told me I could have gotten all the way up to the vice president of the company had I not done that. And I ended up becoming a senior staff engineer. In other words, I took the technical path as opposed to the managerial path. I was afraid the people in supervision were just talking to other people, managing other people, and no longer touching the hardware. And I wanted to be involved in the hardware. That was me. So there's pluses and minuses on each one of those approaches. But as such, I've learned that directional couplers give you a hell of a lot of bang for the dollar. At the average flea market, let me drop it. Some real high quality Nader and other brand name of directional couplers, Hewlett Packard and so on, directional couplers, at an original price range of, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, quite often they're being sold at a flea market for numbers like $10. And you're getting a lot for your money. And these things, as a pass-through item, unless somebody's really done something terrible to them, they last forever. And one of the other well-kept secrets is the directional coupler is useful way beyond the frequency range that's stamped on the cover. I personally have taken a directional coupler that's a Nader directional coupler with type N connectors made for 8 to 12 gigahertz. And I properly calibrated it and used it down at 1 gigahertz, 500 megs, 100 megs, 50 megs. It's rated for 8 to 12 gigahertz, and I'm using it in a predictable manner down at 10 megahertz. The article that I've described to you tells how to do that. They give a very predictable performance at lower frequencies with high directivity. They give a predictable performance way outside of the frequency range. I mean, you may start off as a 10 dB coupler at 10 gigahertz, and maybe it is a 50 dB coupler at 10 megahertz, but it's a calibrated 50 dB attenuator, directional coupler with high directivity at 10 megs. Who in the world would ever think that I could be using a directional coupler 1,000 times lower in frequency and get a calibrated, predictable performance traceable to the bureau? Who the hell would ever believe that? It happens to be the truth. It's another one of those well-kept secrets. Anybody with any questions or comments on all of the above?
Repeater, time out.
Anybody any questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters and names right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. Okay. There being none, I think it's time we go over to the space report. Is somebody trying to sign in?
Oh, where is he?
Okay, go ahead with your, I got you marked off from one side here. WS. W2XJN, KQIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I've sent you the email, which is a video. It's a nice young PhD that makes a lot of videos trying to tear out and show inside different devices. And he was playing the signal path, right? And it happened that he was playing with a locking amplifier, and there was SR Sierra Radio 530. He was able to get to auto, millimicro nano picofarad auto. So he went to auto level of the signals, and he was able to retrieve the signal that was buried in deep in the noise. And I thought that it would be good for the technicians to talk about it. Also, Dr. Roy might be with us talking about how small signals could be registered. And also, talking about the satellites, we have a space traveling devices that are so far away, and we're still able to get contact with them. Back to you, Dick. And maybe Dr. Royce will also with us.
Okay, the best example I know of is the Voyager spacecraft. The Voyager spacecraft is now out there at 13 billion miles, three times beyond the distance to Pluto. That signal, because of that range, experiences 317 dB of attenuation, free space attenuation. Yeah, there's a 12-foot dish doing the transmitting, a 10-watt transmitter doing the transmitting. The 12-foot dish has got something like 48 dB of gain. The receiving antenna down here at Goldstone is a 240-foot diameter dish that's got something like 75 dB of gain. So you've got 75 dB of receiving gain, 48 dB of transmitting gain, 10-watt transmitter, 13 billion miles, 317 dB of free space loss. When you crank that all together, what signal level do they get at Goldstone out of that dish doing the receiving? The answer is minus 154 dBm. Minus 154 dB with reference to 1 milliwatt, which is minus 184 dB with reference to a watt. The amount of power they're receiving is in watts, 3 with 19 zeros after it as a divisor. 3 with 19 zeros. So are they into pico, femto, atto, yocto, zepto? Yes. They're into yocto or zepto watts. And as long as they're using a narrow enough receiver, the receiver that's listening to that super weak signal has a 50 hertz bandwidth. Let me drop it. So the Goldstone dish has a phase lock loop to it that goes down to a 50 hertz bandwidth, even though the signal is at 8.5 gigahertz. Let's assume the band that they're using goes from 8 gigs to 8.5 gigs. Let's assume that's the band. 8 gigs to 8.5 gigs. That's a 500 meg possible bandwidth they could be using. They're using 50 hertz of that. That means they could put 1 million channels in there, 50 hertz wide each. Or is it 10 million? Some number like that. How do you know you're on the right channel? That's because of the smarts and the way the deep space network is set up, where the uplink frequency becomes the reference for the downlink frequency. You don't have to worry about crystal oscillators on board that are drifting and so on. It's a very crafty system. So by going down to a 50 hertz bandwidth, that is a kind of a lock-in amplifier. It is a phase lock loop. It is a lock-in amplifier. So as a piece of laboratory test equipment for ultrasonic frequencies, audio frequencies in the noise, there's a kind of lock-in amplifier where you tell it the particular frequency region you want it to find a sine wave signal. You tell it what resolution bandwidth you're going to use. When it eventually finds that signal and sets it up with a phase lock loop, it will follow that signal as it drifts in frequency and measure its specific amplitude. Goldstone is able to measure a minus 154 dBm signal coming from the Voyager spacecraft 13 billion miles away, launched 40 years ago. The 10 watts coming out of that traveling wave tube is still working. The dish has something like 6/10 of a degree of beamwidth. The transmitting antenna at the Voyager spacecraft, let me drop it. It is transmitting a pencil beam. The main lobe of that dish, 12-foot diameter dish, 8.5 gigs, is 6/10 of a degree of beamwidth. Maybe it's 7/10. All of that has to be aimed directly at the Earth, otherwise all of that gain goes down the tubes. Within approximately 1/10 of a degree in azimuth and 1/10 of a degree in elevation, the dish, 40 years later, is still aimed at the Earth very accurately. They can talk to it virtually every single day. They talk to Voyager saying, what kind of magnetic field are you measuring in the interspace network beyond the bubble coming from this sun? The solar wind produces a bubble. That bubble has ended. Voyager is now seeing interspace particles much, much stronger than the solar wind particles coming from the sun. It has left the building. It has left this particular solar system. So, 10 to the minus 19 watts cannot really be measured. They're doing it every single day. What's the weakest signal you can measure? There is no limit. You have a sensitive enough receiver, a low enough noise figure, a big enough receiving antenna, a narrow enough bandwidth, and therefore you have to make the modulation rate very narrow. Voyager is only talking to you at 50 bits per second, but it's talking to you from 13 billion miles away. It's another example. Let me drop it. It's another example of the magic of radio. Everybody thinks radio has, each individual radio has a finite distance. The answer is no. You connect a transmitter to an antenna and you transmit a signal. That signal goes to every cubic meter of this universe. You wait long enough, the signal gets there. How weak can you receive that signal? What's the limit? There is no limit. You use a sensitive enough receiver, a high enough gain antenna, a narrow enough receiver bandwidth. As you make the receiver bandwidth more and more narrow, every time you half the bandwidth of the receiver, your receiver noise goes down by 3 dB. Your signal stays the same in the narrow bandwidth, as long as it's got the right kind of modulation rate. There is no limit. You use the right hardware and the right techniques. That signal goes everywhere in this universe, and you can't stop it from doing that. That's the magic of radio. So measuring picowatts, femtowatts, attowatts, zeptowatts, yaptowatts, absolutely. There is no limit as to how far you can take that. Ain't that crazy, Wes? N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Interesting. Dr. Roy had a few suggestions to going even lower than that. I was trying to catch him on the word when I said, well, because there is nothing smaller than our metric system than ATO. And, of course, I was expecting him to protest, and we got to Planck minimum charge. But before we go to that, a few words from me. Let me jump.
Yeah, let me interrupt you for a second. Show you an explanation, a calculation that I did once that scared me. Let me drop. When you're listening to that signal coming out of the waveguide to coax adapter, the little piece of probe wire on the receiving site at the Goldstone dish, the signal is minus 154 dBm at 8.5 gigahertz. A signal of 10 to the minus 19 watts is the signal. And now you calculate, assume it's a 50-ohm line, and you now calculate how far are the electrons moving back and forth at 8.5 gigahertz to represent that signal on that probe that's receiving that signal from the Voyager spacecraft. How far are the electrons wiggling back and forth at 8.5 gigahertz? You go through that calculation, and you realize they're moving 1 millionth or 1 billionth the diameter of an electron. The electrons are moving that far in order to represent that signal strength. Is that possible? We're getting down to a Planck wavelength type thing here. I mean, what's the limit as to how small a motion of the electrons can be, which represents the signal strength, that is still detectable? It appears that that also has no limit. You use the right integration factor, the right bandwidth, noise equivalent bandwidth of your receiver. The electrons don't even have to move by an amount that you can talk about. We're talking about a fraction of the diameter of an electron is the amount of movement of those electrons that represents that signal strength. You would say to yourself at first, that's impossible. That can't be detected. Well, they're doing it. N2XJN, K2RIW.
DC2GS?
That's what I was thinking about. Dr. Roy, pick up.
Yeah, what's the smallest amount of motion of an electron that is...
Repeater, time out.
WD2HWW, with a question on this subject.
You're gonna have to stand by a little bit. You're gonna have to stand by a little bit, Howie. Roy, I think there is no limit to how small the motion of an electron can be with the right instrumentation, and it can still be measured. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS, I think you have to deal with Planck's length. There's a length beneath which the granularity of space-time, unfortunately, falls apart. So there's something that's short enough that you can't get any shorter. It's Dino's paradox about cutting a line in half and half again into infinity. It doesn't work because of quantum mechanics. And also, electrons don't actually have diameters. They're conceived of as a point, a dimensionless point charge, which is annoying, but that's what they're defined as.
Yeah, but talking about the vibration, how much the electron could shift. Well, we have it constantly taking place in infrared region. So the infrared is actually stretching the molecules and stretching the fundamental particles. In between, we could talk about electrons. Dr. Roy.
Well, I think we're talking about quantum noise here. Let me get a beep. Below a certain signal strength level at certain frequencies, there is something called quantum noise. And when I talk about an electron moving, and by the way, there are some people who estimate that the apparent diameter of an electron is something like 10 to the minus 31 meters. I've heard numbers like that tossed around. Is it real? Who knows? On top of that, when it comes to how many electrons are we talking about here, you're now getting down to what is the diameter of the probe, the wire itself, that's conducting this current, the skin depth of the signal flowing on that wire, and how many real electrons are we talking about? If we're talking about the motion of one electron, yes, we'd be in trouble. If in reality on that piece of wire that's picking up that signal, there is 50 billion electrons, and they're all moving around in a somewhat random manner, Gaussian distribution of their instantaneous velocities, because of the physical temperature of that element, of that piece of wire. How many degrees Kelvin is it at? However, as long as your receiver has a narrow enough bandwidth so that Johnson noise becomes something you can tolerate, the random noise, and now we're talking about the average motion of some of those electrons that constitute a signal. And by way of the 50 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth of their receiver, that is one huge integration factor. Billions of electrons, and you're looking at the average motion of billions of electrons, and adding up what you think is their average physical motion that represents that signal strength. Except for the quantum noise of the physical temperature, I think there is almost no limit here, Roy. If I have a narrow enough bandwidth, which means I'm integrating a large enough number of electrons.
Repeater, time out.
If I'm using a narrow enough noise equivalent bandwidth, which means I'm using a big enough integration factor of a large enough number of electrons on that particular piece of wire, I think I can come up with an answer that's always weaker. Where this starts breaking down is if I start making transistors that consist of one single molecule, so to speak, and now is Moore's law going to break down when I start building super nano transistors that are only one or two molecules per transistor? Can we now clearly talk about the noise figure of that device? Crazy question. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, when you get smaller, it gets crazy and crazier. I don't think our understanding of solid-state electronics at this point allows for anything that works as an integrated circuit when it comes to only a few atoms. You need a crystal lattice of some kind to have P and N holes and such that are the basis for all the semiconductors technology that we're using. So they're going to have to come up with something really fancy and something extremely new. As far as the electron diameters, they cite the 10 to the minus 30 meters because that's the smallest measurement that we can tell that an electron is smaller than. But, you know, there's no machine that can show that it's smaller than zero. So that's why we have the 10 to the minus 30 meters at this point.
Yeah, but in terms of communication, we have a problem because one of those go belong beyond the wavelength of the particular electron that, due to the duality, acts as a wave. That means we cannot go smaller and smaller. There is a certain limit. What do you think about it, Dr. Roy?
Well, along these lines, Dr. Tom Williams and I, WA1 MBA, once did a calculation. We tried to do a calculation. Assuming I'm using a milliwatt transmitter into a dipole antenna that's 1 inch long at 10 gigahertz, located on the Earth, I'm aiming this thing at the moon. It's got no gain to it. I'm getting a moonbound Zeco coming back to that particular dipole antenna. You got 245 dB of loss. 10 gigs, I think it's a 290 dB of loss round trip.